This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and my guest today is Jorge Fierro, founder and CEO of Rico Brand. Jorge's company offers over 150 Mexican ready-to-eat products to nearly 100 supermarkets, coffee shops, and restaurants across the state. Getting his start at the downtown Salt Lake Farmers Market in 1997, Jorge has grown Rico Brand into a multi-million dollar business, and his products are now available at local grocery stores such as Smith's, Harmon's, Dan's Market, Whole Foods, and others. Join us this morning to hear how Jorge left law school in Mexico to pursue his American dream. Jorge Fierro, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Good morning, Doug. This is great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, you know, the nice thing about Rico Brand is it's available in a lot of grocery stores here locally. I suspect a lot of our listeners have heard of your company. But for the few that maybe haven't, tell us about what Rico Brand is.
Well, Rico Brand is a line of ready-to-eat Mexican products in supermarkets. And usually, you know, your regular supermarkets such as Smith and Harmon's, Fresh Markets, Whole Foods, and some of the associated food stores markets would have this product. And so it is in about 100 different supermarkets in a mountain region. And hopefully moving to another state rather soon.
Okay. And as I said in the open, you got your start at the Salt Lake Farmers Market. And it was a slow start. Tell us about the first couple months, the first year or two.
Well, when I came to Utah to learn English, landed in Utah after a few months of being in the States. And the story goes that I was washing dishes and I was going to an ESL program at the school called Horseman House. Now is the school over here on 13th South and Main Street. Sorry about that, I forgot the name. You know, one day I was homesick and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning and I was living in this house sharing the bathroom and the kitchen like students do, and finished working as a dishwasher at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I opened a can of refried beans to make a bean and cheese burrito, and I was totally disgusted with the quality of those beans. And so the idea came up in 1987, launch a line of ready-to-eat pinto beans at the downtown farmers market in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was probably the fourth or the fifth year that the farmers market has started, so there was plenty of room and it was pretty interesting. I was able to experience some of the early years when Utahns started getting really excited about having a summer farmers market where you can see some fresh vegetables and fruits and things here in Utah. And so I brought a bag of pinto beans, and at first it was kind of odd because who's going to buy beans, right? So the first week I took 20 bags of pinto beans, 32 ounce, as I said, fully cooked, ready to eat, and I sold 2 bags. And I was a little taken back because I thought, you know, beans are so good for you. I mean, how can they not like beans? But you know, I had to do a little bit of research and came up with some recipes that would have the Rico beans in them. And I started giving those recipes away. And so people started buying the beans the following week. And about the third week, my mother and my father were here from Chihuahua. And my mother makes this creamy salsa called chile con crema. And it's really tasty. Is served warm, and so I started selling the chile con crema as well. That was my second product at the farmers market, and as you know, farmers market has an end every summer towards the middle of October. But it was a little bit of a challenge, obviously, but I was really gung-ho, and I knew that I had a product that nobody had, and so
So food's a tough space, right? And I suspect, you know, at the farmer's market, you can go and you can make a decent profit. But when you expand into the grocery stores, you know, my father was in the grocery store business. It's a very low margin business. It's a very tough space. And the suppliers feel the impact of that. So when you decided to expand and go into the stores, and I'm going to come to how that came to be, but how did you overcome the hurdles associated with, you know, needing to provide them the supplies? Probably they pay 30 days, if not 45 days. And so how did you go from being at the farmer's market to having a business that could supply the grocery stores?
Well, that's a great question, you know. Very few people ask that question, and that was such a hurdle, you know, in my career. And the truth of the matter is that after the farmers market ended, I had applied for a loan with the Utah Micro Enterprise Loan Fund, which is you know, worthy of mentioning simply because of the fact.
I'm glad you did mention it. I had it in my notes as well. They gave you a $10,000 loan at a time when probably they were the only source of capital for you.
That is correct. And the reason why is because I haven't had any credit build up under my name. And so I obviously wasn't bankable. And so, you know, through a friend of mine, I heard about the Utah Micro Enterprise Loan Fund. And back in the days, the maximum they let someone borrow was $10,000, but you really had to give them a business proposal, and you had to make a presentation in front of the credit committee. And so I told them what I was going to do with those $10,000 if I were one to be picked. And so I made that presentation with the committee, and I told them exactly what I wanted to do. And so one of the things that I noticed is that Mexican food is probably one of the most popular ethnic foods in America. I mean, you have, you know, pizza there, and you have Chinese food there too, but Mexican food, everybody
likes
Mexican
food. It's one of the top
three.
Yeah, I would say it's
the top
three.
Yeah, indeed. But I didn't want to really, you know, come to a town and rent probably the cheapest corner or the cheapest, you know, building and open a restaurant. I never thought that I would open a restaurant, but you never say never.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Indeed.
Spoiler alert, you ended up breaking that that promise to yourself.
That's exactly correct. And so, but, you know, I decided that I was, so my father and my mother came to Utah, and my father passed away, but both business owners, entrepreneurs in Mexico, and they came to Utah to help me get started with the business. And My mom said to me, you know, I will cook for you guys Monday through Saturday, but Sunday is on you, Jorge. So you either take us out for dinner, bring us some food, or cook for us. And so, I mean, back in the days, I wasn't, you know, making that much money, so I couldn't take them out every Sunday. And so I went through supermarkets trying to look for products or ingredients that I could utilize that were maybe partly cooked and or maybe cooked products that I can put together as a meal. And I couldn't find anything. So that kind of pretty much, you know, allowed me to think that ready-to-eat products, Mexican products in supermarkets would be a good move. And so what happens is that seeking for that product or looking for that product and not being able to find it is what popped the idea of eventually, you know, come up with a line of products. Obviously, it started with the beans because my mother had a small business in Chihuahua, Mexico, a bean business. And so I thought, well, we know how to make the beans, you know, and then after that, I can probably, you know, start making salsas or something else. But I really didn't, if you could have asked me back in the days what I would do in the next following 10 years, I probably wouldn't say, you know, Rico brand.
Right.
And
right.
So everything was.
What were you thinking back then? What were you thinking how you'd spend your next 10 years?
You know, I knew that there was room for a better quality food in the supermarket industry. And I'm not sure if you recall, but back 20 years ago, you could find frozen Mexican meals and foods in supermarkets. There's some companies put out there that are extremely low quality, that you know, frozen and probably old, but the idea actually wasn't thing to compete with those companies, but instead trying to do something different, trying to present something fresh with no preservatives and no additives, which, you know, after 21 years, I've kept it clean. I haven't. And still don't use any preservatives.
So I know of your products from the refrigerated section. Are all your products refrigerated, or some frozen, or some shelf stable?
You know, I used to have the three of them, shelf stable. I used to have four different kinds of tortilla chips, but I decided not to put them out there because I don't make them. I had a company making those tortilla chips under my label, but I do have frozen and refrigerated sections. In the supermarkets, in the frozen, have about 25 different kinds of frozen burritos, which are very popular. We sell a lot of that product.
That's a lot. The grocery stores would call them SKUs, items.
Yes.
That's a lot of SKUs for you to manage. So you have 25 different types of burritos. Why? It seems like five burritos ought to satisfy 95% of the population, but that's not the case.
Well, it's truly not that it's not the case, but simply, I try to please everybody, and the vegan population is extremely large in Utah, so is the vegetarian population. Meat lovers obviously like their chicken and their pork and their beef and.
Well, I'm actually glad to hear you say that. Being vegan myself,
yes,
and it's hard to find good quality vegan products. Although in the Mexican aisle, it's a lot easier. You mentioned earlier about beans and how they're so healthy for you. It's just not a part of the standard American diet, but they're incredibly healthy. I mean, there's all kinds of health, and I eat probably four or five servings a day of beans. But I've just been vegan recently, and so I learned all this stuff about beans. Do you think, as you look forward 5 years from now, 7 years from now, do you think the popularity of beans in the United States is going to increase, or is it just a cultural thing that's been that way for 50 years and it's probably going to be that way for the next 50 years?
No, I think that, the new generations are seeking to eat well, to eat better, to eat healthier. Sure, I mean, grains and different kinds of natural foods have been on diets in the minority world or in third world countries. And so beans are extremely healthy for you. They're very affordable.
They're really a superfood, and they're crazy cheap to buy. And you offer an easy way for people to get them. I'll also say they're really easy to cook, and it's kind of hard to mess up fresh beans. I like just if I go over a friend's house and they made fresh beans, I've never had bad beans that have been made fresh. I've definitely had bad beans out of a can.
Sure.
So, anyways, my plug for legumes, the superfood, and I think American, very popular in Mexico, not so popular here in the U.S. Hopefully that'll change for a lot of reasons. It'd be great for your business. It'd also be great for the health of Americans.
Well, legumes are extremely popular amongst the native population. And I think that, in our society, oftentimes legumes are seen as not such a great food, maybe because it's very available and very affordable. But the truth of the matter is that legumes are excellent for
your diet.
They're good
for you. Yeah, they're good for you.
Indeed.
Okay, so let's go back. So we talked about getting into the grocery stores. We talked about your start at the farmer's market, selling two bags at the first farmer's market. That's starting to grow slowly. Building a business is hard. When did you feel like, I think I've got something here. I think this business is going to now survive. You're not in survival mode anymore, but now you're in growth mode and you have the foundation, you have the support that allows you to think about the future versus worry about surviving day to day.
Well, so after the farmer's market, obviously, as I said, applied for that loan. The loan was given to us or to me at the end of November of 1987, and that's when I rented a little corner on 8th South and 5th East that later on became Rico Mexican Market. I utilized that because there was a commercial kitchen, and everything that you put out on the market has to be done in a commercial kitchen. So I met requirements, And then I apply with the U.S. or with the Utah Department of Agriculture to be able to get the license to put those product, that product, the beans specifically, in supermarkets. But it was a little bit of a time for me to be able to do it, because they could not believe that I could put some beans out there with no preservatives, and that they would last up to a month in the refrigerator. So I had to prove that to the Department of Agriculture here locally.
Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Jorge Fierro, founder and CEO of Rico Brand, a company that makes gourmet, ready-to-eat Mexican food.
All right, so that's you were proven to the regulators, to the inspectors, that beans could survive a month in the refrigerated section, which obviously is really important if you're going to be in the supermarket section, because you don't want food coming back. And that's one of the things that makes selling to grocery stores hard, right? When you go to the farmer's market, you can kind of control the inventory, less so with the grocery stores. How big of an issue is that for you with your grocery stores and the coffee shops, product coming back, and how do you manage that?
Well, you know, as I said from the beginning, we, you know, one of the things that really separates my food from other companies is the fact that we use no preservatives and no additives. And so having to present the product in such a great stage such as this farmer's market, it was easy for me to be able to market that product to those customers that really love something that is fresh and healthy for you. And so what I did is that I was always managing my inventory in order for me not to have to throw anything away. But at the same time, it's not that I throw anything away. I utilize everything, or I give it away, or I feed people. And so I think that, you know, being thoughtful in that, in those respects had made it easier for us, for the consumers to support us, knowing that we are extremely engaged in this community as well. And so what happens is that I build a company based on the fact that if a product couldn't go out the door, that that could have been utilized to feed someone that was hungry out on the streets, or just to give it to the food bank. And so, you know, I don't forget that obviously come from a country where a lot of people are starving. And so for us, you know, disposing of food or throwing stuff away is not in our DNA.
Exactly, and it shouldn't be. It should not be in your DNA. In fact, you have a project that you call the Burrito Project. And you provide food, and during the summertime, it sounds like up to like 1,000 burritos a week. Tell us about that program.
Well, you know, back in the days when I landed in Utah, I didn't speak any English and I didn't know anybody. So I ended up staying at the rescue mission. I was really afraid that I was going to be stopped by police. I had a sleeping bag on my back and a essential cloth on me, but, you know, someone, you can always find someone, you know, that speaks Spanish. And I was told not to be seen sleeping on the streets because police would pick me up and take me to jail. And so I was afraid. And because of that, I found a place to stay. In the beginning, it was the rescue mission. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, I found the shelter, the men's shelter. Back in the days, there was a men's shelter and a women's shelter. And I remember that you could go in the shelter, you had two choices. One of them was to stand in line until they would let you in. If you were lucky, you could get in, and or you could pay $2.25 if I can remember back in the days. I mean, this is 33 years ago. And so because I was working for SOS Temps, I was getting paid like $27 a day. So I thought, you know, enough for me to pay for the shelter. So I live at the shelter for about 2 months. And when I was living at the shelter, I met this guy from Puerto Rico, Joseph, that I could communicate with or through. And I learned back in the days that a very high portion of the homeless population were vets from different wars. And that literally broke my heart. I come from a country where we don't engage in wars. And I just couldn't understand how vets that give us our freedoms and our liberties are treated with such a disrespect. And so I thought, you know, someday I'm going to pay it forward. And I didn't know how to do it, but it impacted me so much that it was always in the back of my mind. What can I do to make a difference? What can I do to say thank you? What can I do to send the message that we love them, that we care, and that we appreciate who they are and what they've done for us? And I said it for us because from the moment that I came into America, I felt like an American. I love America. It's a fantastic country. But we also have a lot of work to do, more so than what people think. And so eight years ago, I was approached by a couple of people that had the idea of the Burrito Project. And Burrito Project is a nationwide or a worldwide idea of feeding people out on the streets. And so if you Google Burrito Project, you can see burrito projects in San Jose, California, in Los Angeles, in New York, even in other countries. And so when I was approached, I thought that it was a perfect way of getting involved in the community. So I immediately agreed to do it. And so there is still one of them that came along with that group of three people that approached me that is still part of the Burrito Project. But I took it pretty seriously, and I've been so blessed that I thought, well, you know, if I cannot give burritos with rice and beans, which is protein, you know, I think that I feel that I'm not successful. You know, when you go to any of Latin American countries, you end up in the kitchen. You know, we love to feed people. And so I thought, well, it's just up my alley. You know, I can feed people and I can send the message. And so that started almost 8 years ago, and I took on that project, and it's actually very dear, close to my heart.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a great program, and thank you for doing that. Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Jorge Fierro, founder and CEO of Rico Brand, a company that makes gourmet, ready-to-eat Mexican food.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Jorge Fierro, founder and CEO of Rico Brand, a company that makes gourmet, ready-to-eat Mexican food. So before the break, we were talking about your experience immigrating here to the United States. You ended up in Salt Lake City really to learn English. Tell us what the first year was like for you coming here from Mexico. So you were in college, you were studying law, you decided you wanted to come to the U.S. What was that first year like?
So, yeah, you're correct. I actually, and I think it's worthy of mentioning, obviously, that I was born and raised into a great Mexican family. My father and my mother always provided for, you know, my six brothers and one sister, eight of us. So I was always a student, and I always practiced some sport in Mexico. But since I was very young, I wanted to come to the States. I found out that Americans have a very philanthropic mind, and it kind of picked my brain. I thought, why are they like that? You know, and this happened since I was like 3 years old.
Had you visited the United States as a child?
No, I never had back then in the days. But I remember, you know, we live very close to the border, and there's a huge influence from America onto northern Mexico. And so I remember seeing John F. Kennedy's assassination on TV, and in the same token, I can see the different programs that Americans have done throughout the world. And so I immediately was attracted to, as I said, the philanthropic work that Americans do throughout the world. And so I thought, you know, someday I'm going to have to go and study their minds and see what's up with that, you know. I was fascinated by it. So I grew up in Mexico, and eventually it got to the point where I decided that I wasn't going to make a great attorney in Mexico. So I made the decision to come to the States to learn English. And so my father was extremely disappointed, obviously, that I that I left university behind and I came to America. But I had told my father that I wanted to come a little deeper into the States to force myself to learn English. And so after a couple of months, I landed in Rawlings, Wyoming. And because I didn't have any money with me, I had to stay in Rawlings and work as a sheep herder. And so you can only imagine how my journey started in America with a huge wake up, right?
So I'll probably not have the chance to ask this question to a sheep herder again, or it'll be a long time. What's the job of, I think of a sheep herder as somebody that's walking along with the sheep and taking care of 20 or 30 sheep. I'm probably wrong. It probably involves a jeep and thousands of sheep. What was it like being a sheep herder? What is that job?
Well, I work with a very large company in Rawlings, as I said. I was at a time where it's a great way of getting to know the sheep industry. And so it's in the spring when when the lambs are born, when the wool is sheared from the sheep, and from the time where you have to separate the males from the females, to be able to castrate the males and bulk them up to sell them, and then keep the females because they're the ones that produce. And then later on, take care of a bunch of 2,000 sheep up in the hills of Wyoming with your horse.
Were you out there by yourself with 2,000 sheep?
I was. I was up there. The next camp was a few miles away where I could visit throughout the day. And it was great. I had to learn how to ride a horse because that was the only way I could move in the hills, and had to cook myself. And It was a great journey. It was truly, talk about being so lucky to be put in a position on which it made me think what my next move was going to be.
Yeah, you probably had lots of times to think. You said one of the reasons you came up here was to study the minds, and I think it's pretty close to a quote, study the minds of Americans. You've been here now 30 years. Are there still things about our culture that surprises you?
Yes, all the time.
Give me an example.
Well, it's just amazing. When you see America in the stage, America is a different America. But then when you come to America and have the opportunity to live America and to be an American, then you see the real size of America. And, the stage is huge. The stage, American stage is humongous. But when you start getting to know Americans on the regular basis, it's just a little different, I think that...
I bet it's very different than the America that you thought you were coming to.
It is, especially nowadays after 33 years in America. It's fantastic. But I also think that we are influenced by so many different things nowadays that oftentimes we tend to lose our head a little bit, or we tend to shift a little bit and to forget who we really are.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I always said is, let's make sure that we don't forget who we are.
Yep. No, I think that's great advice for anybody. And America today is very different than it was three decades ago when you came to the United States. Do you think you could have survived those first couple years in the United States as it exists today?
Doc, of course I would. I'm one that nothing stops him. I'm one that I'm so determined to.
You think my sense is it's tougher today than it was three decades ago. Is that fair?
Yeah, yes, of course it's fair. Yeah, it is tougher. But at the same time, the opportunities in America are still there. And oftentimes as Americans, we just cannot see straight. And let me remind people how you have to take advantage of the opportunities. And if you don't, it's because you think that you are the American that will be taken care of, through the system, and we're not. We cannot think that the system is going to take care of us only because we were born in America. The opportunities are there. You got to take care, on those opportunities and be successful.
What advice would you give somebody that's thinking about, somebody from Mexico that's thinking about coming to the United States, knowing what you know about the U.S. now, what would be a couple pieces of advice you'd offer them to make that transition easier for them, more successful for them?
Well, you know, I'm going to be quite honest with you. I don't think that I have the experience needed to be telling someone, you know, what to do, or to be telling my fellow Mexican men or women, you know, what would be different than back in the days. I probably would say don't come to America. I probably would say, you know, wherever you're from, make sure that you are great at what you do at that place, and try to make your communities better, and you know, you may not find what you think that you may find in America anymore. You may not find right now at this time in your life the embracing that Americans have had in the past. You may not have the opportunities that we have had in America in the past. It's a little bit tougher nowadays, and I don't think that people would like to put themselves in a situation in which they may be treated with so much disrespect.
Okay. Well, thank you for those thoughts. I'm going to leave it there. We're not a political show. We're a business show, but I appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Jorge Fierro. He is the founder and CEO of Rico Brand, a company that makes gourmet, ready-to-eat Mexican food. We talked earlier. I teased about the restaurant business. You started off making ready-to-eat Mexican food, started off at the Salt Lake Farmers Market, got into grocery stores, was kind of thinking, gee, never want to get into the restaurant business. That's really a tough business. But in 2012, you decided to dip your toe in there. You decided to open actually fine dining Mexican food, Frida Bistro. I'm sorry, it's actually 2010.
Correct.
That you did that in front of the warehouse where your business is located. What made you decide to do that?
Yes, you're correct. It was back in 2010, and right in front of the manufacturing, we used to have our offices and our employees' break room. And so back in the days, I had so many employees, and we was offered lunch for our employees. So we had the dining room up front. And so people that will drive by, they thought that it was a restaurant. So they would stop by thinking that it was a restaurant, and they would open the door and see my desk and apologize and leave. So I thought, well, maybe there's an opportunity for me to sell some of the food that I'm already making hot and ready to eat. And so, as I tend to say, that I opened my big mouth and decided to open Frida Bistro back in 2010, but obviously that area wasn't zoned for a restaurant. So I came to the city. I went to the city and I talked to economic development and to permits, and I wanted to open a restaurant, but I was declined because it wasn't zoned. But back in the days, Bob Farrington, which is a great friend of mine, and he's passed on to a better life. He back then helped me out, and he says, you know, Jorge, I'll help you. I'll help you to open a restaurant in this area, but you have to wait a little bit. So the city came back, and they told me that if I could make 75% of my food to go, that I could open a business. And so before I opened Frida Bistro, I opened a place called Cafe by Rico. And you could come in, and I remember having this huge pink counter, and you could come in and order your tamales or burritos or whatever and use one of our tables if you wanted to, until Mr. Farrington worked it out with the city, and they finally gave me the permit to open as a restaurant. So I decided to remodel the whole building up front and open Frida Bistro.
Okay, and that's in an area that we call now the Granary District. Tell us about, I'd been in that area. I didn't know it had the name Granary District. Tell our audience, what's kind of the vibe in Granary District, and what's that area like today?
Well, nowadays is a project area. The city and a nonprofit organization called Main Street USA are now paying attention to that area to redevelop that area, and it's becoming, and it will become probably one of the hottest areas in Salt Lake City. It's also known as the Warehouse District. And the vibe is actually, it starts getting kind of a nice at night. We have, they just opened a third brewery. More restaurants and more small business are moving in, along with a lot of art. They have just unveiled about 12 pretty large pieces of art or...
Murals?
Murals, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Murals. And so it's been nice, but I think that... I'm not really sure if it's Rico brand, and now it's called Rico Cocina y Tequila Bar. It used to be Frida Bistro, but now it's called Rico Cocina and Tequila Bar. And I'm not really sure if those two businesses will remain there much longer.
Okay, you were talking about artwork. Your original restaurant, The Fine Dining, was named after an artist from Mexico. Tell us about her and why she was such an inspiration for you that you named your restaurant after her.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, and a lot of people think that that I might have been in love with Frida Kahlo, and you know, sometimes I like to think that I might have been her lover in my last life. But the truth of the matter is that I've always feel that I'm an ambassador of my culture in America. And the reason for that is because I want Americans to love who we are. We're not a threat to America. We've always been our neighbors or neighbors. We've always been the husband and the wife and the employee and the boss, and we have always been around. And so, you know, as an ambassador of my culture in Utah, I want Americans to know that we are good people. And so everything that I do, whether it's Rico brand and or Frida Bistro, always has a bit of a cultural side to it, so people understand my culture better. And so it's almost like I'm a messenger from a different place.
I love that term, you know, being an ambassador to America, and in thinking about that as a business person. And we need to wrap up, but before I let you go, you know, you're an ambassador to outsiders. You're an ambassador to your customers. You're also an ambassador internally, and probably where you have the most influence is with your team. Tell me about your team. You know, you've been doing this 20 years. Have you had people that have been with you for most of that journey, and who are a couple of your key people?
You know, thank you, Doug. That's very nice of you to say that. I have a fantastic team, but I have also been have the need to refresh my team through the years, and I actually had to refresh one of the my team after I was a subject of an internal audit from Homeland Security. And this is something that most people don't know, but I think that, you know, that I think is a big part of my life. But the team that I have is a fantastic team. I only have very few people in my team that started this business with me, because most I had to let go, once again, as a subject of an internal audit. But it's just the people that come into my team, and I talk to them, and I tell them exactly, you know, what the team is all about. But oftentimes, people who have the interest of being a part of my team, they know of, you know, how I work in this community and what I do in this community, they want to be a part of my team. And so for those who are no longer, you know, part of the team, obviously they're the ones that got us started. And then the ones that are my team now, it's very important to obviously let them know that if it wasn't for these team members, I wouldn't be who I am. But most importantly, to the community at large, because the truth of the matter is that I always, you know, and for a long time, I always said that I was born in Mexico, but I was made in Utah.
I love that. That's a great phrase. And, you know, it's humbling when you think about the people that have given years of their life to your company and helping you build the vision that Rico brand is today. And my last question is, as you think about the next 10 years, where do you see Rico brand going? Where would you like to take it?
Because of the fact that I know that the Rico brand line of products is quite diverse and high quality. And every time that I travel in America, I tend to go and check supermarkets, which my wife, you know, thinks that I'm crazy. Every time that I go anywhere in America, I run to supermarkets, chains, and try to see if they have anything similar to what I make. And the truth of the matter is that they don't. And so eventually I would love to see this line of Rico products to be nationwide. If not, all of them, at least the frozen section. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still a business owner. I'm a businessman, and as soon as, the longest I have to go to the office, I'm going to grow it. So the growth is part of my, you know, my DNA.
That sounds like a great game plan, and best of luck bringing that to reality. Jorge, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
It was a pleasure to be here, Doug, and I thank the community at large and ex-employees, new employees, and I really want to keep on telling people that I've never used the work that I would do in this community to sell one bean. But the only thing that I want to tell people is that I put my money where my mouth is, and I love this community. I belong, and I would always be loyal to this community.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Our guest this morning has been Jorge Fierro, founder and CEO of Rico Brand, a firm that makes gourmet, ready-to-eat Mexican food. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Christian Camargo. Thank you, Christian. You can hear my entire interview with Jorge on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.